Well, let's get our views on James Corbett, what he thinks about what's going on, because after all, he is certainly observing this full-time. He's an economist, not a financial advisor, he says, but he's an observer, and a very astute observer at that. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for that intro, Dr. Stan. I'm blushing ear to ear.
Well, tell us what you think of what's going on over there in Cyprus. Is it solved now, or is this simply the first shoe dropping?
Well, I suppose that depends on whose perspective you're looking at it from. I suppose it's solved from the Eurozone's perspective, because the markets at least have gone back up in the hopes that this is some sort of resolution to the issue. But I think what we're seeing is that this is not a resolution that's going to work out in favor of Cyprus, certainly, the people of Cyprus, or any of the investors or depositors there, who, of course, mostly tend to be Russians when we talk about the large deposits. But actually, interestingly enough, we're now getting word that the Russians have probably been quietly withdrawing their money from Cyprus over the past week, even when the banks were shut down, because there are related banks that are in other countries that were not restricting withdrawals, that had absolutely no limits or caps or any blocks on withdrawals. So there's quite a large likelihood that the banks have already been drained of the money that was supposedly going to be used for this bailout. So it just keeps getting worse and worse. And this on the back of the Dutch finance minister, Dieselbloem, who gave an interview saying that this was going to be a template for future bailouts in the Eurozone, a saying which he had to later on retract, because obviously that was going to cause a lot of carnage and mayhem when people started to realize that this is supposedly going to be the blueprint going forward. So a lot of ways that this is not going to work out, I think, in anyone's favor, except for the very few that put this through as potentially some sort of blueprint or template that could be used in the future for taking the funds out of the banks and putting them in the hands of the banksters.
Well, that thought will be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is James Corbett, who, of course, is one of the lead authors and writers for International Forecaster, which is put out by our good friend Bob Chapman before he passed away. But since we're talking about what's going on in Cyprus today, and they've established a new precedent, and that is basically if you have your money in the bank, and the bank makes bad investments, and after they make good investments, they make the profit. You don't get any profit. You simply get the interest they pay you. But if they made a bad investment, well, they can simply take your money to make up for the bad investment that they made. And simply, it would appear that a certain number of the people who had their money in Cyprus, in the banks in Cyprus, they're just going to take a large sums of it, whether it's going to be 20 or 30 or 40%, the figure seems to change on a daily basis. Now, James is saying that some of the Russians have been very quietly withdrawing their money. They knew this whole crisis was coming, but some of them even though the banks are closed, they've been withdrawing their money from other banks. But, James, how could that possibly be? Because then how would the other banks, certainly, who've been giving the Russians money, how are they ever going to recoup their losses?
I don't think they're going to in that sense, but again, it's only hurting the Bank of Cyprus and Laiki Bank in Cyprus itself. So I think the banks that are affiliated with them don't really mind. But it was one giant loophole in this entire process, because of course the banks have been closed during the time when this restructuring was supposedly going on, as you would expect it to be. But leaving the back door open like this is just a ridiculous oversight when you look at it. And it shows that there's definitely some more going on behind the scenes than we knew about with regards to this bailout. But I think, again, it shows that the people who are going to hurt the most out of all of this are, of course, the people of Cyprus, who lose their main foreign investors and basically the lifeline that they had into their economy. As people have been saying, who's going to be staying at the Four Seasons for $500 a night now? It's certainly not going to be Angela Merkel. I mean, who's going to take that place that the Russian oligarchs were providing? So I guess that goes to show, when you put your entire economy based on providing to foreign investors, this is the type of thing that can result. But and again, there's also indications coming out that the EU has been pressuring Latvia not to pick up the spot where that Cyprus was taking by offering some incentives for Russians to deposit their money there, with threat that they will not be invited into the Eurozone should they do that. So it seems that this is, in a certain extent, a kind of financial proxy war being waged against the Russian oligarchs at the moment, which
hold
is interesting.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Basically, of course, what happened as far as the Cyprus banks were concerned, you had a lot of people from Russia and from other countries who were putting large sums of money into the Cyprus banks. They were paying a better return than other banks were, and they had certain element of bank secrecy. And so basically, Cyprus was encouraging people to put large sums of money there. Now, of course, the whole idea was that, well, the Cyprus banks then made a lot of loans. They bought Greek bonds. They bought Greek bonds. And, of course, because Greece was paying 8 or 10% interest on those bonds. And then, of course, when the Greece defaulted on their bonds, and, of course, this is one of the questions that I have, they certainly didn't the Greek banks have derivative contracts to guarantee their other purchases. I would think that any bank would have so the insurance on the bonds they were buying. Do we have any idea about that, James? Did the banks have derivative contracts? Did they have insurance on their purchases? And if they did, why weren't they compensated?
I don't know that specifically. I'm with you, though. I think that probably does exist, and it might be the question of working through the labyrinth to try to resolve that. As we saw, for example, in the fall of Lehman Brothers, the biggest part of all of this can be the derivatives that are backing up the deposits, which can work into the billions and upon billions of dollars, and can threaten really the system itself when it starts to unravel. So it may be that unraveling that chain may take a while. I really don't know the status of that, but it is certainly something that we have to keep our eye on this, because as you say, this is the primary way that that deposits are insured these days, through credit default swaps and other such exotic financial instruments.
Well, of course, our whole financial system is built upon banking, and basically we make money, we put it in the bank, we get interest on that. But the biggest thing is the banks certainly guarantee our money, and it's safe in the banks, and we have this feeling of safety, but it's all a perception. And the real problem is that so many of the banks are insolvent, have been made bad loans, housing loans. That is why the Federal Reserve is pumping $40 billion every month into mortgage bonds to try to stabilize the banking system. And they may be doing that for years. They don't have the money. They're just sort of creating that money. Or maybe some of the banks are actually lending the money to the Fed, and then the Fed is buying the mortgage bonds to give the money back to the banks. So it sort of goes in a big circle there. But then, of course, the Federal Reserve is purchasing the Treasury bills, $40 to $45 billion every month. Why are they doing that? Well, if the Fed didn't buy the bonds, nobody else would. And if nobody bought them, the Treasury would not have money to send out the Social Security checks, the Medicare checks, the Medicaid checks, the welfare checks, the food stamps. Basically, of course, the Fed is subsidizing the central government today. But how long can they continue doing that? They say they're going to do it until the economy improves. But what happens if the economy doesn't improve? What happens if this goes on for 5 or 10 years? Can the Fed continue subsidizing the banks? Can the Fed continue subsidizing the U.S. Treasury with money they don't have? How long can this last?
Well, it can't last forever, obviously, and that's really the question of when that bubble is going to pop. And no one knows the answer to that, but we do know that it is coming, and we know that we see it coming in a lot of the different charts and things that we're looking at. And exactly as you indicate, of course, the $40 billion a month that's going into the mortgage bonds is being used to back up and basically bail out the banks in a stealth move. It's not called a bank bailout, but that's essentially what it amounts to, because those are the ones that are holding those particular instruments and getting to put them off their balance sheets. And of course, indirectly also, that's fueling the current housing bubble that they're attempting to run up in the U.S. economy, and that we've seen starting to build up in the last few years. Amazingly enough, it's almost difficult to believe that they could go from popping a housing bubble back in 2006 to popping another one a few years down the road from now. But apparently that's the plan, and I'm not sure exactly what their end game with that could possibly be, because it's not going to ultimately help the system to once again get people's equity back up in their houses. Because unlike the last time, I think they're already overextended when it comes to debt. So this probably is not going to get them to incentivize them to take out any more debt if their equity in their houses starts going up as a result of this bubble. So again, it's all a lot of sleight of hand and tricks that are being played right now. But I think, again, it goes back to that fundamental underlying point that you made there, that this is all about perception. That is exactly what this is about. And hopefully, if anything comes from this Cyprus scandal, it's that people get a renewed sense that their deposits in a bank are not pieces of paper sitting in a vault somewhere that are secured. These are general unsecured liabilities of a banking sector that is prone at any moment to go into meltdown. And unfortunately, we've seen that happening time and time again in the recent years, and we're likely to see even more of it as the Eurozone continues to spill over into Italy and Spain and other countries. And we'll see what happens in those countries. But if what happened in Cyprus is any sort of blueprint, then I think people should be at least extremely cautious about the money that they're keeping supposedly parked safely in the quote-unquote vaults of the banks.
But of course, if you don't put your money in the bank, where would you put it? I mean, you're going to put it into bonds? I mean, because I don't trust bonds. You're going to put it in the stock market? Are you going to simply put it in a hole in your backyard? Of course, with inflation just destroys it. I mean, what are people going to do with these people with large sums of money? They've worked their whole life to, you know, preparing so they can have money when they want to retire. But how can they be certain their money is going to be there? Well, my understanding is that a lot of people are being told, get your money out of the Spanish banks, because the Spanish banks are in a very, very similar situation. The Cyprus banks, maybe not quite as bad, but they do not have the assets there that they're supposed to have, and certainly any sort of a major financial crisis could do the same thing in Spain that happened in Cyprus. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly could be the case. And the question of, well, then where do people put their money? Of course, when we're talking about investment, we are always talking at some level about faith in the overall system and that it's not going to melt down during the time between when you deposit and when you actually take your money out. And that's, again, something that just can't be adequately predicted, at least not down to the hour of the day that's going to happen. So it's always a risky decision of where and when and how to store your money and how to invest. But of course, the one, as we've talked about before in this program, one of the assets that has maintained its value for thousands of years has been precious metals. So again, precious metals can't be seen as inherently risky form of savings as some of these others. But and we are poised once again for gold to take off. We see some of the charts looking very much like they did back in 2006, 2007, before gold began its current meteoric rise, and well before it was even over $1,000, and now we're over $1,600. So again, I think that's probably the quote unquote safest way. But again, not a lot of people want to put that much gold in their backyard or whatever the case may be. So I think to a certain extent, they're going to have to work with what they have within the system as it exists, and try to diversify enough that whatever meltdown may occur in one or another sector won't completely take out their whole savings.
And, well, are you suggesting then that people are, if they have money in the bank, would be in a number of different banks with the hope of these, that some of them would survive if the whole thing collapses?
Not only a number of different banks, but perhaps even a number of different currencies, if that can be done. Because, again, in this time of global currency war, what we're going to see is one currency tanking in relation to another. And that can be a difficult game to play in and of itself. But, again, if you have different banks in different accounts and different currencies, even that could potentially be another safeguard. And again, this is all about just trying to safeguard the money that can't all be put into one or another type of investment or savings. So again, I think diversification is probably the key, because in times of great instability, like what we're seeing right now, that's one of the only things that will be able to protect even a portion of those savings.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Here in the Central Coast of California, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, our guest is James Corbett, and we're talking about what's going on in the world today, the foundation of the whole world monetary system, I believe, is going to begin to implode. I believe, of course, everything is based upon faith in the banking system. And there's no reason to trust the banking system because, of course, there's the six major banks in the United States that control almost 70% of the assets of this country. And, of course, they all tie into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. They all tie into this small group of very wealthy people. And they control almost 70% of all the financial assets. We have another 5,000 or more banks out there. We used to have 8,000 banks. An awful lot of them have gone down, but we have an awful lot of banks there. And those banks are having... Essentially, the remaining 5,000 banks control about 99.8%. There's 99.8% of the banks control about 30% of the assets, 31%. And these six major banks control most of the rest of it. Are those banks stable? And we're talking certainly about J.P. Morgan, Chase, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. Are those banks stable? Can we trust them?
In a word, no, but it's important also to keep in mind that this is, of course, not only the backbone of the American banking sector, but, of course, the world financial markets, basically. So I think at the time when we start seeing major shakeups in the big six in America is the time that we can look for a major changeover in the international financial order. I don't think you can have a major default of a JPM or a bank like that without it having massive ramifications, not only on America, but on the entire international financial structure. So I don't think that they're safe, and I think that they are prone to this type of crisis, and perhaps even a crisis by design in order to usher us into a new financial order. But again, when we start seeing the types of things that we're seeing in Cyprus happening, playing out in America with the big six banks, I think that's definitely a sign that things are about to come to a head.
Amen to that. We're going to be back in just a moment. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, right now we have Mike calling us from the Scotts Valley. Hi, Mike. How are we doing?
Doing pretty good. I was just listening to your conversation and your guest, and you mentioned about the six major banks. My question is, first comment is that these guys obviously have a plan for one of this, if they're going to pull the plug for transition into something like a World Bank. What do you think that's going to look like? What are the indicators of that happening? Do you think it's going to be like totally suddenly, or do you think that they're going to kind of, be a couple of pre-indicators to them warming their way to pulling the plug?
James, do you have any thoughts at all? How is it going to come about?
My sense is that this would be a process that would be the result of some sort of catastrophic emergency, or at least what's portrayed as a catastrophic emergency, because that tends to work better. And if there are too many telegraphs or forewarnings of this type of event, there might be too many people who would be able to position themselves better and withdraw their money from these phony banks in time to make the difference. So I would assume that it would work better for them to do this as a result of a major emergency or some sort of catalyzing event like a financial 9/11, I suppose. But then again, I can't say that for sure. And there might be a clear sign, a clear stage to this crisis, moving, for example, from the Eurozone to the U.S. dollar, to the Japanese yen, to the U.S. dollar, perhaps. And it might be something that you have a clear forewarning of. But again, I think it would probably work better for them if it happened all of a sudden.
And right now, of course, Mike, the dollar is certainly as good a currency as any of them. But we don't know what they're up to. They know what they're up to. Certainly, we could be certainly moving into a war over there in the next year or so in the Middle East, against we could be the Psalm 83 war that's described in the Bible. We don't know what they're up to. But certainly, this could happen slowly. It could happen rapidly. We're just going to have to wait and see. Otherwise, it's all conjecture, at least from my point of view, it is. Anything else, Mike?
Yeah, additionally, Well, we understand at least as much, but it's always about redistribution of the wealth and, the wages of people's labor. But how do you think it would also, a collapse in the banking system, affect the way that the IRS collects what they say is the taxpayers' obligation? This banking system goes down. I mean, that's going to have wide ramifications for people's ability to pay what the IRS states that they're obligated to owe them. How do you think the IRS is going to, amend their policy or have to suspend it or have a different way of enforcing it? Any comments on that?
Absolutely. Well, you notice that what's happening in Cyprus right now is being called a tax. They're calling it a tax, even though, of course, they've just shut down the banks and are just going to take 40% off the top of uninsured savings. So I think...
Mike, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're getting an awful lot of static there. But go right ahead and answer that, Go ahead.
Right. I think it's interesting to see the way that they're trying to portray this as simply a tax. And that is, I think, a framework, a blueprint, a template for what they would like to be able to use in the event of another bailout or financial collapse system scenario. Because, again, this is the easiest way to basically collect money off of the people, fleece the people, as it were, in the event of something like this, because as the caller mentions, it's going to be extremely difficult for the IRS or other agencies to collect taxes.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly we had Mike calling in from Scotts Valley, certainly asking about what was going to happen, and of course James has said that he really feels that there's going to be a slow process temporarily, and then of course it should be some sort of a cataclysmic event, and this would certainly, the American people would accept the cataclysmic event, and they would not frame the banking system, but you have to understand this is all orchestrated, and of course what's going to happen is a few people are going to gain fabulous amounts of money, and most people are going to be impoverished. The people who spent their whole life working, accumulating money for their old age, is going to lose it. The pension funds are going to get a collapse, and the money that the people will get out will buy very, very little. The same thing is going to be true for every aspect of our society. And of course, I think down the line, the welfare state is going to collapse. There's not going to be the free food stamps for 48.8 million people. That's where we are today. 48.8 million people are getting food stamps today. We have the most wonderful situation. We have free medical care. We have few housing supplements. We have certainly food stamps. But eventually, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to stop because we're going behind over a trillion or a trillion and a half dollars every year. And you can't keep doing that indefinitely. And either the Democrats or the Republicans want to accept that. What are they talking about? Oh, we're going to cut spending by $85 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about a deficit of $1.1 trillion this last year, and the same thing for the year 2013. And what are our fearless leaders going to do? Or they're going to cut spending $85 billion in the year. And let's go right now. We have Harvey calling from Daytona Beach, Florida. Our guest is James Colbert. And Harvey, do you have a question at all for our guest?
Oh, absolutely, Stan. Good hearing you guys. You know, James sort of touched on it. You put your money in the bank, and you think it's being held there. But you know what happened with J.P. Morgan, the little bit that we know about, is that they were wild, like wild drunks in a gambling hall. They admit losing $6 billion through their offices in England. And then you have MF Global, and MF Global by John Corzine, who's a consummate insider and ex-head of Goldman Sachs. He took the people's money and just gambled it wildly on derivatives in Europe. Maybe he had some of the papers from Cyprus. I'm not sure, but I wish he would touch on that a little more, how they really are. We're just feeding like a bunch of wild drunks on a gambling spree in Las Vegas.
Well, you're exactly right on that. And for people who don't know about that, they can look up the whale trader in London who, as you say, blew $6 billion of JP Morgan money. And you can also look up the whole history of of the MF Global scam that John Corzine was running. And of course, again, as you say, a consummate insider who was also a former Goldman Sachs executive. And it shouldn't really be a surprise that the banking community is so incestuous in this manner, that there's always the same few characters who populate the very top positions in a lot of these banks and different programs. But again, it just goes to show that exactly as you say, this is all of a piece. And whether it's happening in Cyprus today, right now, that's only contingent. And it's likely to spread to other countries and other banking sectors sooner or later. And it's only when they get their hands caught in the cookie jar that the problems seem to start from the viewpoint of the general public. But you and I have forewarning of this. We know what's already going on behind the scenes, so we can better position ourselves, and hopefully we'll be able to stop feeding this beast with our own funds and our own money, trying to put our money in these so-called vaults, in these so-called banks, and instead investing in precious metals or investing in local currencies or different ways of getting around the system. And hopefully if enough of us can convince enough other people to do the same, we can actually start having an effect and perhaps changing the nature of this system.
But I think the key is to diversify, Harvey. Diversify, the three rules. Diversify, diversify, diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, because if anything happens to that basket, you're going to be wiped out. And I've seen this with so many people, you know. They want to get rich, and they get this surefire means of getting rich. All they have to do is take all their money and invest it, and they're going to end up double or quadrupling it. And they fall into that trap, and they end up losing everything. And they simply become totally impoverished. So we don't know what's going to happen. We're just going to have to keep watching very, very carefully. Anything else you want to say, Harvey?
I just want to say that in the case of MF Global, the courts have already decided that there's no such thing as segregated funds, and they could just help themselves with the billions and billions that they had in trust.
And that's exactly what they did in Cyprus. They just helped themselves with the private banking deposits to bail out the bank that made bad loans. If they made a profit, they would have kept the profit. If they lost money, they took it away from the people. Had money deposited in the bank. If you got money deposited in the bank, just remember what happened to people in Cyprus. And I fear it's going to happen much more widely. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is James Corbett. Give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett. James, what do you think about Swiss banks? What about people who have large deposits with, say, a major bank like the Union Bank of Switzerland? Are these major Swiss banks fairly stable? Should people be concerned about having deposits there?
I think they should, and there's every reason to be very suspicious of banks like UBS and others that in recent years have been having more and more outside regulation applied to them, which is basically undermining the whole point of the Swiss banking sector as it's been known hitherto. Although there are some interesting reports, unconfirmed reports coming out now, that some of the Swiss banks have been trying to woo some of those Russian investors from Cyprus. So we'll see what comes of that. But again, I don't think that I would put my trust in any particular banking sector, even the Swiss banking sector. I think that, again, it's as you said earlier, it's just a question of perception, and it's a game of perceptions. And because the Swiss banking sector has such a sterling reputation, it might be able to coast on that for some time. But I think that eventually it will have to pay the piper, just as all of the other banking sectors will.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Bruce, who's calling us from Durham, Michigan. Hi, Bruce. How are we doing?
Okay. I have watched Mr. Corbett on RT, and the penis from Japan, and that brought to mind Russia. And he's just talking about, who are these Russian investors in Cyprus? Is it like an upper middle class that they have, or are they criminals, or what? I know the Germans are trying to say they're a bunch of criminals, and they deserve to have their money taken. But who are they?
Who are these Russian oligarchs that are investing in Cyprus? Do you have any thoughts on that at all, James?
Well, I don't know in detail about who is investing in Cyprus particularly, but my understanding is that these are some of the oligarchs, the people who basically position themselves to take over the various machinery and factories and the property and assets of the old Soviet Union as it was collapsing, and managed to secure enormous amounts of wealth, which, again, has to be stored carefully, just as, for example, rich Americans will tend to have offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands or other places that will have certain tax breaks and incentives for them. So, too, do Russians have their own version of that, and that would be Cyprus. So that's my understanding of why Cyprus has become such a magnet for this, and because they had banking structures that were particularly lax for the Russians, particularly with tax breaks and incentives and all of that. But
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon, James Corbett, who is one of the senior writers for the International Forecaster. We have Bruce on the line, who is asking, who are these Russian oligarchs that invested all this money in Cyprus we keep hearing about? And because James simply commented that they seem to be the people, the so-called Russian oligarchy, that the people who actually picked up the wealth of the Soviet Union when communism died. Now, basically, in my estimation, the Russian oligarchy, the KGB agents, and they simply, they've changed their name, they're no longer KGB, and now they're Russian oligarchs, but it's the same little clique. And they have a clique that runs Russia just like we have a clique that runs the United States. But, of course, these people don't trust Russia. They certainly know that Russia can move to take away their wealth if they fell out of favor. And so they were putting their money into Cyprus, thinking it would be safe there. But, of course, they're finding out what every one of you out there in the audience should understand, and that is that the banking system, not only in Cyprus but throughout the whole world, is basically unstable. And you better start looking for alternatives. Or remember the three rules of investing. Diversify, diversify, diversify. I said, Bruce, before we get back to you, Mr. Corbett, would you like to tell our listeners how they could get your information, how they could get in touch with the International Forecaster, and how they could get your advice to your own personal publications? Again, this is James Corbett. Numbers 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295. James, how can people get your writings in the International Forecaster? How they can get your writings for your subscribers?
Absolutely. Well, if they're interested in the International Forecaster, I would encourage them to check out the website, theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternationalforecaster.com, where you can find more information about the publication. You can see some of the articles that I myself and others have written for it, and you can also sign up for a free introductory copy to test it out before you sign up for a subscription. And of course, you can also sign up for that subscription there on the website, theinternationalforecaster.com. You can also write in by snail mail if you prefer that. It's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. And if you're interested in my own publication, it is the Corbett Report. It's at corbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And you can find more information about my work and how to subscribe to my own newsletter and or purchase my DVDs there. I should also note that if you're interested in meeting the folks behind the International Forecaster, they're going to be at the Get Prepared Expo in Lebanon, Missouri next month, April 6th and 7th. So if you are going to be attending the Get Prepared Expo, you can drop by and say hello to the International Forecaster crew.
All right, fine. That telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295. But I believe we're living in very, very dangerous financial times. And the one thing you have to understand is that you can never be absolutely certain that something is going to happen to your bank because the banking system is intertwined. And we had a major cataclysmic event of one sort or another. This whole house of cards could come down. Why? Because the banks have lent out a lot of money that they don't have. That's how banking works. Basically, you deposit $100 in the bank, and that lets them let out $1,000. Well, where's the money? They simply created it out of nothing. That's how our banking system works. But they leveraged 9-to-1. But unfortunately, increasingly, we're finding certainly many of the banks, certainly some of those overseas, are lending out 20 or 22 or 24-to-1. What happens if they simply lose the one? Why, of course, the whole house of cards come down. James, would that be a fairly accurate appraisal?
I think so. I mean, we are watching the taking away of the illusion, I think, the curtain around the Wizard of Oz, and I think it's important to understand just how quickly it can all come down. And just on that note of the Russian oligarchs in Cyprus, I think it's also important to note that Russia is now openly considering how it can retaliate against the EU for this, and we have a former Kremlin advisor who's been quoted on record as saying that Moscow is going to be looking for ways to punish the EU, and there are a large number of German companies operating in Russia, so you could possibly look at freezing assets or taxing assets. The Kremlin is adopting a wait-and-see policy, end quote. So we are moving into some very interesting times, and I think it's going to be interesting to see the Russian reaction to all of this.
Hey, Vanderbilt, Bruce, do you have anything else to say before we let you go?
I wondered about Russian retaliation, and this is the other more refined question. Have they now spared the Cyprus bank depositors because they're under 100,000, and the brunt of the balancing act will hit the Russians because they're over 100,000?
That's exactly what this appears to be, because, of course, the major investors, the people with more than 100,000 euros, tended to be those foreign investors and mostly Russians. So that's exactly what's happening right now, and that's exactly why I think Russia is understanding this as a direct assault on them rather than simply something that's being done in the Eurozone generally. And, of course, they had to keep the 100,000...
When the Russian, there was a Russian ambassador, and I believe Medvedev himself was involved. They went to Cyprus, and they were going to hammer out some deal. Was that forced upon them? Like, was that Christine Lagarde said, go there, make a deal, or we'll do this to you?
My understanding was that they were attempting to do a deal around or behind the backs of the European Union, and I think that they were trying to get something alternative established so that the EU wouldn't be able to do this, but I don't think they were able to do that in time. That's my understanding at any rate. I don't know if they were actually asked by the EU to do that, but I assume that they were not.
Bruce, I think we're going to have to wait and see. We'll know in a couple of days what's going to happen. Okay, God bless, and thanks for calling. And let's go to Joe, who's calling us from Arkansas. Joe, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I do, and my question is, I understand that Russia has been allies with Iran against the United States, and that also Russia has been allied with Assad against NATO and against the United States, and against, I guess, what you would call the Western NATO powers. And so I wondered, do you see any evidence at all? Do you think it's at all reasonable to speculate that maybe this move against Russian money in Cyprus is a move to weaken Russia's position in respect to Iran and to Syria?
Well, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the one undoubted consequence of what's happening in Cyprus right now is that it will be affecting these Russian investors and affecting their savings. So I think whether or not this is intended specifically as an attempt to get at Russia or not, it certainly has that effect, and that could not have failed to escape the attention of the people who were putting this deal together. So if they wanted to really avoid some sort of confrontation with Russia, I think they would have been able to come up with some sort of deal, or at least to involve Moscow more in this whole process. So I think that this has to be seen at the very least as a shot across the bow of Russia in a number of different ways. And the fact that the EU is now specifically threatening Latvia, saying that they won't allow them into the European Union if they allow this money from Cyprus to go into Latvia, shows that this is more of a coordinated strategy to deny these Russians investing safe havens.
Well, I would simply hope that our listeners would get hold of my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, because I would like to suggest that nothing is as it appears to be. We have certain precepts about Russia and about the conflict between Russia and the United States, and certainly between communism and the United States. But it's not based upon fact. In fact, those of you who haven't seen my interview, it's called The World Revolution, and you'll see my interview with the ambassador to Cuba in 1959. Earl T. Smith, a multi-billionaire, was kind enough to invite me and a film crew down to his home there in 1980. And before he passed away, he left this legacy, where Gracie talks about how we installed Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro, the communist, he didn't have the support of the Cuban people. He didn't win the revolution. We put him in power, and it wasn't we didn't know he was a communist, as Ambassador Smith says. The president knew, the CIA knew, the FBI knew, he knew, everybody knew except the American people, and they lied to them. Why? Well, because we had to have an enemy, a very convenient enemy. And that is, in my estimation, exactly what Russia is today. Putin's from the KGB, and the KGB is always very, very, very closely with the CIA. And I'd like to suggest that reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king. We're going to see this thing unfold, but I'd like to suggest we're not getting a lot of the truth. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or some of the other books we have, books by Dr. Cuddy, and you can get those on the Internet. We carry some of them, but a lot of them we don't, because they've driven the cost up. Why? Because he tells the truth, and we can't let the people know the truth. So you'll find out that some of these books will cost you $50 or $100 to get a copy of books that I got for $6 each when they first came out. Why? Because it's an active program to largely control what the American people think and believe. Well, let's go now. We've got Les calling us from Michigan. Hi, Les. How are we doing?
Hi. Good, Dr. Stan. Hey, I've got a question for you and James both. We know that, China and Russia, they're really adding to their gold supplies heavily in anticipation of the collapse, you know, incoming. And as a follower of Bob Chapman and everything, you know, he was always recommending mining stocks and everything. But they really just, I know they can manipulate them, but they're really clobbering, you know, the mining stocks right now. I was wondering, James and both of you, why aren't the Chinese and the Russians coming in and scooping up these stocks and scooping the press right?
All right, fine. That's a very, very legitimate question. And incidentally, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. 464-8295. And James Les is saying, look, Sophie, mining stocks should be an excellent investment, especially since the price of gold and silver are going up. And yet, of course, the prices are very low. And why aren't the Russians and the communists coming in here, the Chinese, coming in and buying up these stocks at such ridiculously low levels? Well, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, as a matter of fact, actually, there are stories out about how China is, in fact, investing in foreign mines directly, not just in the stocks, but actually directly investing in foreign mines. And you can find that, for example, on GATA's homepage, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee at GATA.org. They had several stories up about that and China's direct investments in the mining sectors in foreign countries. So I think that they are, in fact, doing this, but they're doing it very quietly. They're not making a big deal about it. And in fact, about a week and a half ago, the vice governor of the Bank of China came out to say that China has not added anything to its gold reserves since the last time they announced a change back in 2009. It's now still officially at 1,059 tons, which I wouldn't believe if they paid me to believe it. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that they haven't added a single ounce of gold in that four-year period. So I think that they are working extremely hard to do this as quietly as possible, but they are investing directly in mines in foreign countries. And, of course, buying physical gold as well. So I think, again, we should be watching what gold, what China does rather than what it says when it comes to gold.
And another thing, Les, Sydney's a little off the subject, but here we hear about really how big, well, things are going here in the United States as far as housing and how, of course, the price of housing is going up and more houses are being sold. But who's buying all these houses? Is this a Mr. and Mrs. America? And I've heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard that the Chinese have set up large corporations that are coming in and buying up large numbers of homes here in America. Why? Because they're holding dollars, fiat dollars, that really are worth nothing. They want to convert them into something of a tangible value. And certainly they have massive cities over in China with nobody living in them. Cities that will house, 20 or 30 million people. Buildings, certainly apartment houses, homes, and they're just sitting there empty. So they're coming over here and they're buying American homes and either renting them out or just hanging on to them. I've heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but 1 in 10 homes that is being bought by the Chinese. Have you heard anything at all about this, James? Is there any truth to that?
I haven't heard about that specifically, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. As you note, they have trillions of dollars in U.S. dollar foreign reserves, and so they have a very serious investment in not seeing the dollar collapse all of a sudden, or at the very least, if it does, for them to be holding tangible assets rather than paper dollars.
And I think this is the big thing, Les. People should be getting into tangible assets because the smart money is doing that. They're not just putting their money into paper money. Because there's nothing behind any of it. It's all a matter of perception. And reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king. And that illusion is that money has value. Money that's backed by gold and silver has value. Money that's backed by nothing but faith in government has very little value. Anything else you want to say before we let you go, Les?
Well, I guess that's pretty well explained it, but I just think there's going to be, these people just can't help themselves. They're going to create one big bubble, on the mining side here before long or something.
Okay, I think you're probably right. This is probably not a bad time to think about making an investment. The trouble is that most people really are a little short on funds now. I don't think the Chinese are. I think they got lots of money, and I suspect they're investing it in tangible assets like mines all throughout the world. But you're not going to read about that in the New York Times or the Washington Post because they're all controlled by the Brotherhood of Darkness. Hey, thanks very much for calling.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Frank, who's calling us from Salinas. Hi, Frank. How are we doing? Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. When you say China is buying gold, is that the Chinese government or the Bank of China? Is it the banks in China, the commercial industrial bank of China? Who is buying the gold and who is holding it?
All right, fine. Do you have any thoughts on that, James?
Yes, well, it's important to understand that the banking sector in China is, of course, controlled by the communist government. And so when we talk about the Bank of China, it is the government. And just like the central banks in any other country, when they are buying gold assets, that is considered the official gold reserves of the country. So again, the Bank of China's holdings is the benchmark number. Although, of course, there are a lot of now private commercial transactions taking place for purchasing gold in China, and that market is certainly growing. And they're buying several hundred tons of gold per year for the private sector as well. So it's important to keep that in mind. But absolutely, when we talk about the Bank of China, we are talking about the official gold holdings of China.
Okay, does that answer your question, Frank?
Yeah, good. Could you name a couple of the banks that are not the government banks of China?
I think all banks in China are government banks. Everything in China. It's a communist country. Everything is controlled. They may have private names, but they're all controlled by the government. Would you agree or disagree with that, James?
That's my understanding, that there isn't a bank in China that isn't controlled at one point or another by the government. There are different banks that operate there that have different functions, but I think they are all adjuncts of the government at one level or another.
Okay, does that answer your question, Frank?
How about India?
Well, that's an entirely different situation. They do have an element, certainly, of a private enterprise system there. However, certainly India has been collecting a lot of gold. Apparently, some of the bureaucrats there are trying to discourage gold ownership, but the people inherently know that they want something of inherent value. Unfortunately, the American people honestly believe that money has value. I think an awful lot of them are going to learn the message that most people in the world understand. It's going to be a very painful message when this whole house of cards comes toppling down. I think it's going to happen. I don't know when. It's not a matter of if, but when. God bless. Thanks very much for calling. Well, James, the hour scoots by very, very rapidly when we have you on. I always enjoy it. Well, you've got about 2 or 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, I just want to draw people's attention, now that we're talking to India, talking about India and China, I want to draw people's attention to a very important event that's going to be taking place this week that probably is not going to be covered a great deal in at least the front pages of the major newspapers, and that's the BRICS Summit that's going to be taking place starting tomorrow in Durban, South Africa, and it's going to be a 2-day event. at which there could be even the possibility that they will announce progress on this idea of a BRICS development bank. Of course, this is the grouping of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And they have last year decided that they were going to move ahead with a development bank as a type of supplement to the existing IMF World Bank structure. But it does have the possibility of one day becoming a real rival to that international financial structure. And depending on some of the details and how they get worked out, for example, will they loan in dollars or will they loan, for example, in yuan? That can make a huge difference in that calculus we've been talking about the replacement of the dollar as a world reserve currency. So potentially some very large events are going to be taking place in Durban over the next couple of days. I hope people will keeping their eye on it. I certainly will be on my side and will probably have some reports up on my website about that in the coming days.
Well, I think that people have to understand that it's not a matter of when, but if whether or not the dollar is going to lose its position as leader of the world currencies. I think it's a matter of when. I think there's no question at all that, as every other currency has held a position of prominence for a long period of time, certainly for many years, the British pound was the predominant currency, and then, of course, after the First and Second World War, England managed to bankrupt itself, and eventually, of course, the pound does, and although certainly it's still a currency, it is not the predominant trading currency in the world today. And I think the same thing is going to happen as far as the dollar. I think the dollar is going to lose its position of prominence and lose a great deal of its value. What are your thoughts on that?
I can't help but agree. I think, unfortunately, the system as we've known it is coming to an end. And I say unfortunately because a lot of people will fall through the cracks in whatever changeover occurs. And hopefully the listeners to this program will be at least aware of what's coming and hopefully better able to position themselves. Again, diversify to help get around what we know is coming sooner or later.
Well, God bless you. Thanks very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you here. We'll look forward to talking to you an extra week at the same time. Agreed?
Absolutely. The pleasure is mine. I'm looking forward to it.